You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, home of McFog the Dog.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the secret Canadian history of that 90s softcore infomercial phenomenon called Girls Gone Wild.
It was hot girls having a blast. There's nothing wrong with that, I thought. It was aspirational. I did not yet realize that we were, in fact, shooting porn, and that was actually happening in the back room of the bus that we were living on.
Wait for that. Our world, of course, is full of porn. It's just porn everywhere. More porn than ever before. And the porn has seeped into everything, it seems. It's in our fashion. It's in our music. It has warped us and our children. It's changed our ideas about sex and dating and about relationships. Our ideas about our own bodies are different because of porn. Modesty seems to be gone. Romance, dead. And people just regularly make this wild decision to shoot porn of themselves, to mimic what they see in porno, and then just send it all over the place. And all of this started with the internet. But did it? Because there's actually a problem with that narrative. A problem called Girls Gone Wild.
Girls Gone Wild is traveling coast to coast, meeting the cutest, sexiest girls in the country to find the hottest girl in America. These are the kind of girls you've always wanted to meet, just the way you want them, naked and ready to go wild.
So hot.
Girls Gone Wild was born in 1997, which is not technically pre-internet, but certainly well before the internet flooded our culture in porn. This is before the Kim Kardashian sex tape. This is before the Paris Hilton sex tape. This is before Pornhub. This was before porn went mainstream. You know, it's before porn was just something that everybody sees at some point when they're growing up. And the technology that Girls Gone Wild was built on, it's very pre-internet. I mean, this consisted of video cameras, cable TV infomercials, and mail order VHS tapes. So what is the significance of Girls Gone Wild today? Why is it worth remembering? One thing that occurs to me is that Girls Gone Wild proves that we didn't need the internet, or at least girls or young women, very young women, did not have to grow up around porn before deciding to pornify themselves. They did it all on their own. They did it for fun. They did it for the t-shirts. And they did it in Canada. In the year 2005, Courtney Kosak was a merch girl on the Girls Gone Wild bus, which was a traveling caravan that rolled into our nation from the state of California, promising the youth of Canada in towns like Red Deer and Kelowna and Banff, promising them wild times, and then returning to America with signed release forms and videotapes, marketable footage of young Canadian women flashing their breasts for the camera and having sex with each other. Courtney Kosak has been processing this experience ever since. Was it fun? Was it coercive? Was it even legal? Was she exploited? Or was she the exploiter? Or was it all of the above? In a moment, Courtney's going to tell you the whole story, the secret Canadian history of Girls Gone Wild and what it all meant. Wait for it.
Whoa.
Warning! This video contains explicit material not suitable for children. If you think Girls Gone Wild was wild before, just wait till you see what these girls do.
Do you remember the late night infomercials for the adult entertainment franchise, Girls Gone Wild? You know, the laughing girls, the lighthearted steel drum music, the bubbly pink pop-up sensors discreetly covering the flashing girls. It seemed kind of innocent. It seemed kind of fun.
It just seemed like a wild party. You know, like a wild party where these girls were apparently having a good time, and that's just what I thought partying was after seeing that.
Girls Gone Wild wasn't just ubiquitous on late night TV in the late 90s and early 2000s. We were swimming in its cultural influence. Girls Gone Wild was everywhere.
Girls Gone Wild.
Girls Gone Wild.
Girls Gone Wild.
They're college girls and they're wild. They've gone wild.
They've gone wild.
They've gone wild. We gotta have it. I can't have it sent to my house. Susie will kill me.
You might think Girls Gone Wild was a distinctly American fiasco. It was a multi-million dollar fiasco, but a fiasco nonetheless. And yes, of course, the company is American born and bred, but Girls Gone Wild also operated in Canada. I'm Courtney Kosak, and I know because 20 years ago, in 2005, I got a job selling t-shirts on the Girls Gone Wild tour. My official job title was Merch Girl. And my first stop was Vancouver. That's where I met Daniel.
Hi, I'm Daniel Suplensky, and about 100 years ago, I was a cameraman on Girls Gone Wild, Canadian tour.
Daniel was one of our two cameramen on the Canadian tour. The rest of the crew was a producer, a bus driver, and me. His Girls Gone Wild story started out a lot like mine.
I'd been in L.A. for a handful of months, couldn't get a job. I think a week prior, I was going to the movies, and I went to the ATM machine, and I saw that I had a minus $250, you know, checking account. I was like, shit. So I was just on Craigslist, just throwing, you know, resumes to the wind. So nearing destitute would be the answer.
We were both nearing destitute. He was an aspiring filmmaker. I was an aspiring actress. Both of us were new to LA, struggling to find our footing. I was overstaying my welcome on my friend's futon. And when I saw the Craigslist ad, I was like, hey, this job could be my saving grace. It could be a chance to lower my overhead and stockpile some money to regroup. And then I can start again fresh. But Girls Gone Wild didn't save me. However, it did change me forever. But at the beginning, neither Daniel nor myself quite knew what we were getting ourselves into.
Well, I certainly knew what Girls Gone Wild was. I had seen the infomercials, but I had no idea that I was applying to Girls Gone Wild. It was like, okay, yeah, resume. And I wasn't really even reading some of these posts. And the reply back I got was for like documentary filmmaker experience. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I made a documentary once.
But he still didn't realize what kind of documentaries he was in the running to shoot. He went to their office in a fancy corporate building on Cloverfield in Santa Monica to find out.
So then I go into the building, up the elevator, go through the door. And as soon as I walked in the door, as I'm sure you remember, the big flat screen TVs, you know, going with, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I knew. I was like, okay, this is what it is. Okay, sure.
I also didn't realize I was applying to Girls Gone Wild when I replied to the Craigslist ad posted by Mantra Films, which simply asked, do you want to party and travel for work? Yes. Yes, I did. When I got an email back from Girls Gone Wild, it was exciting. I recognized the brand name. Of course, I had seen the late night infomercials, and they wanted to meet with me ASAP. So I sped over to that same Cloverfield office for my own interview. The guy I met with told me that, sure, the job was selling t-shirts and thongs to adoring Girls Gone Wild fans, but it wasn't just a merch job. It was also about helping the girls who showed up at stops on the tour feel comfortable enough to get wild. Just having a girl on the bus makes everyone more comfortable, he assured me. I sucked in my stomach and laughed and tried to act like a fun, cool girl. And the next thing I knew, I was hired. They wanted me to leave the next day. And before I knew it, I was going through Canadian customs.
Landing, it was all very clandestine. I don't know if you got the same memo where they're like,
yes,
don't bring any kind of Girls Gone Wild merchandise. I said, don't worry, I don't have any. I mean, I was like, not a problem. This is the phone number you contact. You're on vacation. You're a videographer. You know, you're going to do some wildlife stuff. We can't pick you up at the airport, so you're going to take a cab, and you're going to go to this location. All very James Bond.
It did sort of feel like we were starring in a spy movie. The company didn't have work permits for us. The bus had already been kicked out of the country and snuck back in by the time I joined the tour. And on top of that, I didn't quite understand the mission of the tour yet. Not exactly. I had actually never seen a Girls Gone Wild video. I know that sounds so naive, but at this point, I thought the videos were just uncensored versions of the infomercials. Young girls, clearly in party mode, drinking. Yeah, occasionally flashing, but really just having a super fun and liberated time. It was hot girls having a blast. There's nothing wrong with that, I thought. It was aspirational. I did not yet realize that we were in fact shooting porn and that that was actually happening in the back room of the bus that we were living on. And it wasn't just softcore. It was hardcore solo girl and girl on girl porn. And thus, you might have imagined that Girls Gone Wild brought paid professionals to each stop on the tour.
They always assumed that the bus was like full of women.
Yes.
And it was like this wild 24/7 cocaine-fueled party down the road.
But the truth is, I was the only girl on the bus. We were not bringing the party. Instead, we relied on the popularity of the Girls Gone Wild brand to draw out the locals. Then we'd scout for the hottest girl next door type to film scenes in the back of the bus for those videos that raked in millions of dollars. Though apparently the brand was so popular that sometimes the girls scouted themselves. Daniel remembers one of the higher-ups providing his on-the-job training. They had him shoot a scene with two girls who had enthusiastically volunteered to be on film.
The next day, sat down with Tim and Bill while they reviewed it, like a couple, you know, like professors, you know, like critiquing. And they're literally doing play-by-play going, that was a good move. But I'm just getting all creative, like holding it and doing like these panning shots and being real artful about it. Yeah, I was doing like a Terrence Malick kind of a Girls Gone Wild thing. I guess they appreciate it.
Listen, Daniel would have preferred making actual art films, but he tried to make the most of his experience. I do wonder if men had an easier time ignoring the impact of what we're doing. It hit me right away because of the constant scouting, rating, and objectification of girls in my ears and in front of my eyes, not just during the events, but 24/7, because the crew guys were financially incentivized to get scenes. And it turned out finding free talent for adult content was a full-time job. The guys on the bus weren't bad people, but the environment was inherently misogynistic. For Daniel, it all felt above board, or at least legal.
I mean, at that point, to my knowledge, they'd run into some trouble before in the past. So they were pretty careful about that stuff when it came to scenes. Tim was always there. He was the one doing all the talking when it came to like the negotiations. Mm-hmm. He would sit down with them at the table and I would shoot the conversation and then shoot them signing, the girls signing the papers, shooting the papers. He always stressed, you know, that if they seem like they're intoxicated, slurring, we can't have them on camera. So they have to look like they have all their, you know, faculties, I guess.
But of course, just because the crew was being strategic about how they portrayed the girls and made a point of documenting them signing over permission to film them, didn't make anything they were doing remotely noble.
Oh, no, it was definitely objectifying. Even the fact that it's consensual doesn't mean it isn't sleazy, you know, and just tacky, you know, as well.
Of course, the end goal of all of our activities on the road always went back to encouraging the girls to get wild. And when I wasn't selling merch to the horny crowds who showed up to each event, I was busy mixing drinks for the girls on the bus, even though I knew that decisions they were making about participating in scenes would have probably been better made while sober. Not to mention, most of these girls didn't get paid. At least not with money.
I need to ask you to show me a rest, and I'm going to give you a Girls Gone Wild tank top.
Really?
The fact that you put your body out there for perpetuity for, you know, a tank top.
I'm sure the experience was different for each girl, and for some, it was probably a thrilling act of exhibition. But I don't think many of them planned on ending up in a widely distributed sex-filled video scene, with no control over who might see it, for the rest of their lives. Remember, this was before the time when we understood how permanent the internet could be. Before all content was easily searchable and findable. Before we documented the minute details of our lives on social media. I was 21 then. Traveling for work to another country, no less, was fun. A welcome escape from the challenge of trying to jumpstart my career in LA. But the job itself introduced so many questions about power dynamics and agency and consent. Things that are widely discussed and analyzed now, but that I didn't have the proper language or life experience to wrestle with at the time.
So to me, like, driving in this bus across Canada, seeing, you know, Banff, taking the ferry, all that stuff I enjoyed. The only time that I was really like, this sucks, was when we were working.
But the reality was, we were there for work. And even in between stops, when we weren't technically working, our whole world revolved around that huge, garishly branded bus.
You could see that thing from space.
The bus, along with Girls Gone Wild's reputation, made it impossible for me to forget the tour's mission of taking advantage of girls. When I took the job, I thought I was cool, down for anything. But it didn't take long before the circumstances started wearing on me.
I've never been as depressed in my life as I was when I got off that tour. Was that apparent at that point when you were still on the tour?
Let's see. What I remember was always commenting on all the junk food you were eating. I was like,
that was part of my depression.
Yeah, no, I gathered that.
I may have struggled more than my male colleagues with what we were doing at night and what the Girls Gone Wild brand represented, but they weren't immune either.
I mean, I had kind of negative feelings about the company while we were doing it, you know, like pulling over for people to get something to eat, pulling in front of a playground in front of the Dairy Queen on a Sunday afternoon with these families out picnicking, and we're walking off the bus, and I'm just like, I feel like a demon. You know, I'm like, oh man, everyone's just looking at us. Yeah, because we were both in on a joke that this is ridiculous, and
yeah,
this is just absurd and you know, kind of wrong. And but
we needed money.
We needed the money, yeah. I mean, I could. For me, it was good money. Then it was like $600 a week. And plus, we had, you know, the bonus scene money.
Unlike the guys, I didn't get any bonus scene money. So the money wasn't even all that great. According to my tax return, I made just over $2,000 for the 7 weeks I was on the tour. Somewhere in the southeast U.S., maybe like northern Florida or Alabama. It's hard to remember. But I quit. The tour producer was not surprised. It was clear that I had grown miserable. I flew back to LA on my 22nd birthday and temporarily moved back to the Midwest to recover from my depression and recalibrate. A couple years later, I moved back to LA and continued to chase my dreams. Meanwhile, whatever had awoken in me on the Girls Gone Wild bus continued to shift my life in ways I would have never guessed.
Even we couldn't believe what these crazy young co-eds did when we handed them the cameras.
Before we unpack the myriad ways that Girls Gone Wild changed me, let's dive into the history of Girls Gone Wild. How it burned so bright and then imploded so thoroughly. I joined up with Girls Gone Wild smack dab in the middle of the company's 17-year reign. The guy behind it all? A 24-year-old who was born in Atlanta and raised in Laguna Beach, California, named Joe Francis.
People have said, look, I exploit women, that I'm this, you know, crazy party guy who's borderline
which is not the case. It's just not the case. You know, I'm a nice guy. I have a family like you do. And I'm just in a really extraordinary and sensational line of work, I would say, with Girls Gone Wild.
In 1997, Francis was working for an early reality TV show that featured clips of graphic and disturbing content. When he got the idea to license these clips for a new DVD series with a very dramatic name.
Banned from television. The video's so shocking, the censors won't even let us show you this commercial.
This was pre-YouTube, and that kind of violent and gory content was harder to come by, so Banned from Television quickly gained a loyal audience. While producing the series, Francis came across some footage of topless women arrested during spring break. And the Girls Gone Wild brand was born.
If you think Girls Gone Wild was wild before, just wait till you see what these girls do when Snoop Dogg is on.
I mean, I remember I went to every video store in all of Los Angeles County, Orange County, everywhere, because in those days there wasn't the internet. So just to see if it had ever been done before. And it had never been done before. I couldn't believe it. I mean, really, I was the first guy to ever advertise sex on television. And it just absolutely exploded.
Girls Gone Wild blasted into popular culture like a rocket. Within 2 years of launch, the company brought in $20 million in revenue, and Francis evolved from licensing the explicit content to producing it on his own. By 2001, the Girls Gone Wild brand had expanded to include 83 titles, with 4.5 million videos sold. By airing half-hour infomercials on all major U.S. cable networks, Girls Gone Wild became a household name, and Francis became the face of the company. He was in demand and gave frequent interviews on popular talk shows at the time, like the Jenny Jones Show.
This is Joe Francis. You might not recognize his face, but Joe is the president of Mantra Entertainment and the creator of Girls Gone Wild.
By 2004, business was booming for Girls Gone Wild. The company had sold millions upon millions of videos and counted A-list celebrities like Brad Pitt among its fans.
You're a big fan of the Girls Gone Wild videos.
Girls Gone Wild.
I just succumbed to the advertising, I guess.
But soon enough, the legal battles began. Spring Break 2003 went horribly wrong, and Francis was sued by Panama City Beach, Florida, accused of child pornography and a laundry list of more than 70 other charges. In 2006, Francis was sued by several women who had appeared in Girls Gone Wild videos, but claimed they were underage and did not give consent. The Panama City Beach legal troubles kept coming when Francis was arrested and charged with misdemeanor counts of prostitution and drug possession. He was eventually acquitted of these charges, but two of the victims filed a civil case against him, seeking millions of dollars in damages. Over the next several years, Joe's legal problems just continued to escalate.
Girls Gone Wild founder Joe Francis is back.
The 35-year-old is accused of deducting more than $20 million in pleaded no contest to child abuse and prostitution charges.
Girls Gone Wild has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy because apparently Joe Francis owes Steve Wynn $10 million.
After all of this mounting legal trouble, and even as the Girls Gone Wild business was still thriving, Joe Francis's own personal courtroom drama came to a head in 2013 when a judge sentenced him to 9 months in jail for assaulting women at his Bel Air mansion. And instead of serving those 9 months for misdemeanor charges, Joe Francis fled to Mexico. Then in 2014, Francis sold the company to Bang Bros Porn Studio. And it was all over for Girls Gone Wild. I've spent the last 20 years thinking about my involvement with Girls Gone Wild and the effect of this company on American culture and on my own life. I've devoured documentaries. I've written about it for popular online outlets like Slate and the now defunct Nerve. I'm working on a memoir, and obviously I'm telling you about it on this podcast. I've done a bunch of interviews with people who worked for Girls Gone Wild or who were otherwise involved or connected. I even contacted Joe Francis to see if he'd sit for an interview, and no success on that front so far. But I did talk to someone who was actually able to interview Joe, and in the end, she kind of wishes she hadn't.
It's an example I use when I'm talking to people about the bizarre experience of being a journalist, because you can cold call anyone and say, hi, I'm a journalist, and they're like, great, here are my life secrets. And then I guess the dark side is sometimes your head gets a little big and you're like, I can call anyone. And then you call someone and you're like, I wish I didn't call that person. My name is Becca Clarkson. I'm a journalist living and working in Vancouver, BC, who had the experience of interviewing Joe Francis for a profile I wrote back in 2022.
A few years ago, armed with a confidence imbued by journalism school, Becca pitched a story to a small indie Canadian arts magazine for their wild-themed issue, and she walked away with a behind-the-scenes story of her own.
It was an extremely ambitious pitch. I had no idea how difficult it would be to get a hold of that man, and I also didn't fully grasp how maybe damaging is a bit of a harsh word, but it certainly wasn't helping my mental health as I researched more and more about him and more about his involvement in the franchise and the fallout from it. But if journalism school taught me anything, it was be relentless and don't take no for an answer, within reason, of course. And so I just kept reaching out to Joe Francis on every possible platform that I could find and sending follow-ups.
Finally, she got a hold of him on Instagram. He was interested in being interviewed.
After that initial response, it was really hard to get consistent answers from him and actually set up a time. And then one night, it was a Friday night, I was a young person out with friends at a bar, and I just got a number that I didn't recognize, but it was from Mexico. And I knew that Joe was living in Mexico at the time. And so that part of my brain that would normally say, like, oh, it's probably just spam, I'm going to ignore it, it's like, could Joe Francis be calling me right now? And so, yeah, he was on the other end of the line, and I rushed out of the bar. I, like, grabbed some bar napkins and a pen from the server, and I was just sitting on the stoops of this Chinatown bar.
Becca tried to be patient and navigate Joe's clear mistrust of the media. But it didn't take long for him to test her boundaries.
I had some sort of question along the line of, like, I'm mostly interested in understanding what you think your legacy is and how you interpret, like, some of the criticism that you've faced in the wake of creating this franchise. And he said something along the line of, like, well, you know, it's because of the society we live in. Everyone has such puritanical values and everyone's in denial because sex feels good, right? And I was kind of waiting for him to continue. And he really wanted me to answer and just was like, sex feels good, right? And I was just kind of like, I like didn't want to answer. And he wouldn't continue talking and just kept being like, I really want to know, do you think sex feels good?
Did you ultimately answer the question?
Yeah, like feebly. I was just like, yeah. I guess. He was like, right. So you agree. Oh, it just felt so icky.
They scheduled a more formal interview for a few days later, but then Joe hung up when Becca pushed back on a question about his stormy family life. She had to beg, borrow, and steal to get another interview with him to finish her reporting. Eventually, he agreed to talk, but only to answer three pre-written, lawyer-approved questions.
We had our final chat, and it was uncomfortable, and he just, like, ended the phone call with some really lovely statements, such as, like, suggesting that I was probably really ugly because most female journalists are. And then he also told me that he was going to sue me for defamation if I wrote anything wrong about him in my article, which didn't scare me one bit, because I was like, this man is not getting hands on this little artsy print publication from Vancouver. Like, we print 600 copies of this magazine and we don't ship internationally. So I was like, okay, yeah, sue me for defamation. I'm gonna write a really scathing article about you because I feel like trash after this circus of communication. But it was really troubling to me to experience that intimidation and to experience just the way he can belittle someone instantly. And it made me understand how so many women found themselves in positions where they gave, like, maybe what he describes as consent, that wasn't actually capital C consent.
Becca's experience with Joe was less than pleasant. He was controlling, boundary pushing, and demeaning, but not every woman in his orbit was treated that way.